Books unite us, censorship divides us. That's the theme for Banned Books Week. Today's guest owns a shop in Denver specializing in rare and collectible books, including many that have been banned.
When I was 14, I don't know about you, but I wanted the books that people didn't want me to read.
Welcome back for our third Bucket List Community Cafe podcast. We're an online community journalism site for Denver, and we believe we build community by sharing our stories. I'm the publisher and your host, Vicki Collins. September 18th through September 24th is Banned Books Week. Today's guest is Dan Danbaum, who knows a thing or two about books. He co-owns Printed Page Bookshop and has a knack for finding rare and unique books. Dan spent his time as a speechwriter for CEOs before he decided to focus on his passion, books. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
It's Banned Books Week. What titles might people be surprised to know are being challenged?
The Bible, the Quran, virtually anything by John Steinbeck, Harry Potter, anything dealing probably with the Black experience, gay, lesbian books. Might be easier to list the ones that aren't being challenged or haven't at some time.
Why would somebody challenge John Steinbeck or want to ban those books?
Well, Steinbeck was regarded as a communist in his time. His great American novel, The Grapes of Wrath, was a story of people being damaged by capitalist society. He didn't reflect well on the powers that be in the state of California, and I think pretty much every one of his books at one time was challenged or banned in California.
What do you make of these attempts to squash the freedom of expression? You're a book lover. How does that make you feel?
Well, it's disappointing. It's not new. I think the American Library Association comes up with a list of challenged books every year. We used to have a display of them. People were always surprised at some of the titles that have been challenged. I think it's a reflection of the culture war that we're in now, and how people see education and, by extension, books as one of the weapons in that war.
For you, however, you said that reading is a gateway drug. How did you develop your passion for books?
Well, nobody ever is born wanting to grow up to be a used or rare bookseller. I think it was a gradual thing with me. I like to read, and I met a mentor, John Dunning, who kind of introduced me to the world of used and rare books and the idea that there were valuable books to be found out there. And it was a very seductive thing to think that you could go out on a Saturday to garage sales in Denver and find a first edition of the Monkey Wrench Gang for 25 cents. And, once that gets in your blood, it's hard to get out. There really is a thrill in the hunt. And I did that for a number of years when I still had a regular job. But when I got the opportunity to pursue it full time, I did.
You used to go treasure hunting with your father, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we spent Saturday mornings together. That was a time when you could look up all the garage sales in the newspaper, want ads. My background was in journalism, so I'd get out the city directory and call people in advance. You could find their phone number if you knew their address. And I'd ask them if they had books. It disturbed people to figure out, how did I get their phone number? But it helped me get some books. And the spending the time with my dad was just, I look back on it now, he died in 2000, but the best times I had with him were just driving around, talking, and looking for books. He didn't know the difference between Moby Dick and Dick Tracy, but he had a mercantile streak in him, and if he could find something for a dollar that was worth $2, that added a week to his life. He just loved it. And, you know, I always regret it, I guess, after he died, that I didn't maybe set up a situation to create a situation where he could have found some really great books. I think that would have really made him feel great, and that would have made me feel pretty good, too.
And you paid tribute to him when you opened your bookshop, right?
Yeah. Printed Page is a co-op composed of 10 different booksellers. Each one has their own sort of business. My co-owner is John France, and his business is JBC Books. And I named mine Dan Baum and Son Books. I'm the son. And I did that as a tribute to my dad, but also to kind of give a sense of longevity and stability that really wasn't there.
When I walked into your store, it instantly evoked memories for me. I saw Grapes of Wrath and East of Eden and Watership Down. Do other people have that same reaction when they walk into your store?
They do. I think, you know, and you see that particularly with children's books. People are really taken, you know, with some book that was important to them as a child. It's Ferdinand or Mike Mulligan or his Steam Shovel, or more typically, the people will say, you know, the red book about the hippopotamus that made friends with the duckling. You know, they have no idea what they're talking about. But yeah, there is that element, and I think that guides a lot of book collectors too. They're drawn to things that meant a lot to them as young people or children.
What got you interested in rare books and first editions?
Well, the object of book collecting, I'll just say, is to get as close to the author as you can. And in the book world, that typically means a first edition. You know, the thing that is most pure to the author's intent, and that just became, over centuries, sort of the standard for collecting books, to find a first edition. As it happens, book publishers have no consistent way of identifying first editions. They're all different. They change over time. And the real challenge, frankly, in the used book world is figuring out just what you have in your hands. You know, is it a first edition? Is it a later printing? Is it a significant book? Is it something that was seminal in the field of science or literature or whatever? I can't say that was what really drove me to the used book business, but that's a requirement for being in it, being able to understand those sorts of things and where to find those answers about books.
And is that what makes books more valuable than others?
Well, what makes them more valuable is demand and scarcity. But I can't say that there's any magic just to being a first edition that makes a book valuable. I think most books in our store probably are first editions, but most books in our store are maybe $10 or $12.
And then you have some that are very, very valuable. Talk to me about some of the more valuable books that you carry and what they cost.
We have a signed copy of To Kill a Mockingbird that's $1,000. We have a signed copy of Game of Thrones that's $1,000. We've got some kind of special fancy publications of titles like Uncle Tom's Cabin that are several hundred dollars. But we don't have, you know, that Gutenberg Bible that goes for $2 or $3 million. Haven't found that yet.
You also have a first edition of Catcher in the Rye, which is very valuable, right?
I had one. I sold it. Right, yeah. That was pretty special. I mean, that was a $10,000 book at the time.
You don't get these books all at garage sales,
no.
Right?
No, I wish, no.
How do you come across collections of books that are valuable and worth obtaining?
These days, you know, as I said, when I first got into the business, I went to a lot of garage sales and estate sales, and everyone who's ever collected books has some story about something they found, you know, a valuable book at a garage or estate sale. Those are very few and far between. Now most of the books we get because people call us and want us to come out because someone's died or they're downsizing or they're having to move. And that's where we get most of our stock these days.
And every now and then you get a book that has stuff inside it that you didn't expect. You've written about how you met a dead man today.
Yeah.
Talk to me about some of the discoveries you've made between the covers of books.
People leave all kinds of things in books. I had a widow call me a couple years ago to come look at her deceased husband's books. And as I was going through them, I discovered a lot of letters in one of them, and they told me that he'd had a relationship with a woman other than his widow. I didn't bring those to her attention. I found a book, Brothers Karamazov, and it had a letter in it from an inmate to his girlfriend, quite a lengthy thing, and a pretty weird letter that I think would have made her pretty uncomfortable. It had a lock of his hair in it. Ancestor who'd been in the Union Army, and he had letters from Gatling, for instance, the Gatling gun manufacturer. I think he had been stationed in Washington, but as I was going through this stuff, there was a little envelope and very faint pencil written on it was flowers from the casket of Abraham Lincoln. I thought that was pretty cool, just to have that in my hands.
That's amazing.
So, yeah.
You've said when you walk into some of these houses, you can tell a lot by the books they had on their shelves. I believe your quote was, "Our shelves are ourselves." What did you mean by that?
I think that what people read has a lot to do with who they become. And I think that by looking at someone's books, you can infer a lot about who that person was. Certainly what their interests were. First, that they were a reader and probably more intelligent than average. On the other hand, if they don't have many books, you can infer some things about that too. But I find it's almost become like a parlor game to try to understand the person just by the books they left behind. You can follow their interests, see what they were, perhaps see how they grew, you know, what they thought of books. Were they a collector? Did they want books for just the physical objects, or did they want them for education, research, use as tools? Yeah, it makes me wonder, you know, what would someone think if they came into my library? What would they infer about me? So I think about that sometimes.
What would they find in your library?
Lots of boxes. A mess. They'd find a lot of history. I'm particularly interested in local history, Denver history. I like mysteries. I was interested in World War II history for a long time. My father was in it. Books about books and some literature.
And you're a writer yourself, right?
Sometimes, yes, thanks.
You have little pamphlets at your store with some of your essays and things you've written about.
Yeah, my partner, John France, and I, about 4 years ago, started doing these. We call them chapbooks. And the first one was a lot of stories from a monthly newsletter that we do. And it was mostly about authors and book collecting and interesting things about the book world. It evolved into a series of like diary entries from printed page about people we meet and things that happen in the store.
You can find some of those entries on Facebook if you follow Dan Danbaum's printed page bookshop. So what are some examples of books that you won't buy from collections?
Well, anything that's damaged, for instance, encyclopedias, Reader's Digest, condensed books. I tend not to buy paperbacks. There are some exceptions there. There are some from the you know, 30s and 40s, particularly like mysteries that you buy almost just for the art. Guys with 45s in their hands and dames art. There are a series of paperbacks called Mapbacks that were mysteries that had maps on the back that showed the scene of the mystery or the crime, whatever, those sorts of things. I don't buy, like I say, anything damaged. Textbooks, I'm not interested in. Books, simply because they're old, aren't very interesting to me. But, you know, you take as a bookseller, you kind of take a risk with every book you buy. My glib answer to people is that I'll buy any book I think I can sell. But honestly, if I knew what books were going to sell, my shelves would be empty, and they aren't.
What's your oldest book?
I think it's Mr. Pope's Diary, I think it is, 1717.
The Works of Mr. Pope.
Yes, yes.
Describe that book to me when you open it up and what it looks like and how it feels.
Well, it's oversized. It's been rebound into leather. It's printed on vellum, which is calf skin. So a lot of cows died for that book. And you can feel, you know, kind of the texture if you imagine the metal type being pressed into paper with ink on it. You almost feel that texture in the pages.
What did Mr. Pope write about?
Well, that's one of many books I haven't read, so I couldn't tell you that.
It looked like he was a bit of a poet.
Yeah.
And it had the old English where S's
right,
were
like,
F's.
It looked like F's, right? Yeah. People are shocked at how many books I haven't read.
Well, I've never seen a book that old. What books don't you have that you covet? What books would you like to add to your collection that you don't have at this point?
Boy, you know, I think in kind of, I'll answer that in one or two ways in commercial terms. I think any highlights of American literature, you know, first editions of Steinbeck, Faulkner, Hemingway, Willa Cather, Fitzgerald. I like WPA state guides. I find they were very interesting. They were created during the Depression as a way to hire writers, and they were very kind of revolutionary for their time in the way they talked about the states. If I could just order up, you know, any books I wanted to put in the store, a first edition Tolkien book, C.S. Lewis, Harry Potter, Dr. Seuss, all of that stuff. It's very hard to keep on the shelves. Horror books, anything by certain publishers like Arkham House, who published H.P. Lovecraft's books, I would dearly love to have.
You also talked to me about the Green Book, how you would have liked one of those.
Yeah, the Green Book actually was created by a postman in New York named Green, who I think I've got this right, in the 30s, I believe, wanted to make it easier for African Americans to travel in the U.S., and the Green Book was a guide to where you could go in different states that would provide accommodation for you, where you could find a meal, where you could get your hair cut. And it became the Green Book for Negro Travelers. Green eventually enlisted Pullman porters to provide information on different cities. And one of the big oil companies, I don't know if it was Standard Oil, I think it was, would make those available in service stations. And you look at them now and you think, imagine at the time that they were, you know, used and thrown away, but they're very scarce and very pricey these days. You can find them digital copies online. And it's interesting, for instance, to look up Denver. I can't remember the year I found an entry for Denver, but it was only about a half page of places where blacks could safely go.
5 points.
Yeah, yeah.
And you would also talk to me about a Ray Bradbury book that was bound in asbestos.
Yeah, Fahrenheit 451, which Bradbury wrote on a rented typewriter in the Los Angeles Library, the basement of the Los Angeles Library, rented it for 10 cents an hour. And I think it took him about 2 weeks to write that book. It was initially titled The Fireman. It became titled Fahrenheit 451, which refers to the temperature at which paper burns. The story is, you know, set in the future, and books are prohibited, and fire departments don't put out fires, they start fires to burn up books. So some publisher had the clever idea of creating a copy of Fahrenheit 451 and using asbestos to create the boards for it. I've seen a copy of it. I've never handled one, and since it's made of asbestos, it probably wouldn't be a good idea to handle one. So.
But it wouldn't burn if it was made
of
asbestos.
Right, that's the idea, yeah.
And was that a banned book?
You know, I don't, I couldn't say off the top of my head, but that's probably a pretty good guess, yeah. By banned, too, you know, it's not that you can't get these books. And curiously, that, you know, when I was 14, I don't know about you, but I wanted the books that people didn't want me to read. So I'm not sure that's a really successful strategy, whatever these people are trying to accomplish by saying you can't have a book. I think that's almost assured to make it more popular.
So what books are popular in your store when people come in? What flies off your shelves?
The first author that comes to mind is Dostoevsky. It's funny, I mentioned Brothers Karamazov. It's very hard to keep their books stocked. I mentioned Tolkien earlier, C.S. Lewis. Boy, yep. Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird is a hard book to keep stocked. Many people refer to it, they ask for How to Kill a Mockingbird. I want to send it back to the hunting section. But all the classics, I think, are in great demand.
And you have cookbooks, too. You have a lot of cookbooks.
Yeah. Cookbooks are interesting. You know, for a while, I think one of the first uses of the camera phone was for people to go in bookstores and take pictures of recipes. It surprises me sometimes how popular cookbooks are, and I find their history really interesting, how they've always been aimed at different levels of society. Up until the 30s, most cookbooks were aimed at the upper classes because of the ingredients they had were so expensive. But The Joy of Cooking was regarded, I think, as the first cookbook really aimed toward the middle classes.
I remember that was a cookbook that my mother had. Probably all our mothers had The Joy of Cooking.
Yeah, it's very popular. Julia Child's book is, by the way, a very hard book to keep on the shelves, Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
So if somebody is a book lover, how do you suggest they take care of their books so that they continue to hold on to their value?
Keep them in the kind of environment that you like to be in, and that means, moderate temperatures, keep them away from moisture, high humidity, they'll get mildew. Keep them out of sunlight. Sunlight will dry out books and fade the spines, or fade any part of the book exposed to sunlight. Don't smoke around books. Don't handle them when you're drinking or eating. But, you know, I handle every book as if it's valuable. And, of course, not all of them are. You know, there's nothing wrong with reading a book in bed, and I don't think, while you're having a Hershey bar, if you want to do that. But if you think of your books as something you want to preserve and pass on, they're, you know, those simple steps that will keep them in good shape.
Do you like selling books more in person than online?
Yeah, much more so. I used to sell books online, and I found it very unsatisfying. It's also very time-consuming, by the way, just to catalog a book, describe it, and put it online. It takes a lot of time. But I think all of us at Printed Page have the feeling that the book business is more of a relationship business. Online is more a transaction kind of approach. We like to create relationships not only because we like meeting people and making friends with people, but learning about what they like to read, but that also opens doors to what you can suggest to people that they read. So there's, you know, it's not all just friendliness. There's a little bit of a commercial instinct in there as well. We made some very good friends in the business. We had one who would give my partner John a list of mysteries every month that he wanted to read. And John would find them one way or another and supply him. He ended up becoming a very good friend. I remember he came over for Thanksgiving once and we sold him some turkey.
And some books.
Yeah, right.
Do people come in and tell you their stories? While we were in your bookshop, there was a gentleman there who lingered for quite a while. Do people tell you their stories as well?
They do. There's an expression that bartenders, barbers, and booksellers all seem to be sponges for conversations. People will come in and tell us things that you just wonder, why are you telling me this? They're very personal things. And I don't know why they do that. I think it has to do maybe just with the element of story. Books are stories, and people who like books like stories, and they like talking about themselves, I think. But it's one of the, to me, one of the great satisfactions of being in the book business, just getting to know these people. And you think of it, if you're at all, human friendly, what better place is there to be? I mean, I don't think the clerks at Home Depot get that from people, or car dealerships, or I don't know, but they sure do it with booksellers.
You also serve the community by giving books away. Talk about that a little bit, about your community efforts.
Yeah, I think one of the best parts about being in the book business is being able to give books away. We have several routes for that. When we opened, we went to the editor of the neighborhood newspaper and said, what are the needs here? What could we become involved with? And he said, you should get involved with this group called East Denver Fish. It stands for Friends in Service of Humanity. And it's a food bank that actually delivers food, which when you think about it, makes a lot of sense. Not everyone can get in their car and go drive to a food bank. So we started delivering food for them, and it occurred to us that when Fish gets an order, they get the ages of the people in the house, and we'd see a lot of kids in those lists that would come out. So we thought, why don't we just give them some children's books and let them match those books to the ages of the kids and deliver those? It's been very satisfying for us. And I think, you go out to some of these houses and apartments and think, these kids don't have a lot of books. This may be the only book they'll get. That gives us a lot of satisfaction. That kind of morphed into working with the homeless community and people coming off homelessness. And we stock libraries at the St. Francis Day Center, the St. Francis apartments at Cathedral Square, and St. Francis residences at Warren, I think it's Warren Community Church, which is a transitional housing thing. And that's been an eye-opener, too. The kind of books that people will request of us. Very interesting. You think of homeless person, what do they want to read? Well, how about the works of Carl Jung? Or do you have anything on mathematics? It's an eye-opener.
What do you say to people who say they're too busy to read books or they don't read books?
I don't know what you can say. I haven't figured out a good answer for that. Someone was in the store the other day. He came in and surveyed it, and they said, I don't read books. And my immediate question was, well, why are you here? Why go down to the car dealership and tell them you don't drive? I don't understand why you're here. But I think, I hear kind of a suggestion in that I'm too busy. I have a very important life, and I can't afford to spend it reading books, as if that's something that only slackers or lazy people do. But I can't help but wonder how boring it must be to talk to these people at parties, and how empty their lives must be not to fill up their gas tank, so to speak, with books.
So, Dan, how can people get a hold of you if they would like to talk to you or have you come look at their collection?
You can just call. Our number is 303-777-7653. You can also go on our website, printedpagebookshop.com, and there's information there on how to get in touch with us.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity. And thank you on behalf of, by the way, all the people at Printed Page, not just me, John Franson, Chris Harned, Tom Reese, Tom Haight, Sherry Moncrees, Wendy Bartlett, George Edwards. I think I got them all, but thank you.
Thank you for listening today to our Bucket List Community Cafe podcast. If you'd like to know more about us, our website is bucketlistcommunitycafe.com. We are also on Facebook and Instagram. We have a newsletter that comes out every month. And if you like what we're doing, please go to our website and consider a contribution. We are community inspired and community supported. And once again, thank you, Dan.
You're welcome.